We're also pleased to welcome back to the show Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist at University of Illinois, someone who is here from time to time to answer questions about insect control. So if you're having a problem, this can be something in the house, can be something in the home landscape, in your garden. All you have to do is call in and give us the best description of what it is so that Phil can get an idea of what it is we're talking about. And then he can advise you on how to get rid of it or, as I like sometimes to say, also to peacefully coexist if that's possible, because I know often he's said to people, now, is this something, do you really have to get rid of this? Can you live with this? He sometimes even suggests maybe how people can live with it. But if the bottom line is you have to get rid of it, he can tell you how to do that. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Glad to be
here. Again. Looks like the phones are full.
They're all lit up.
So why don't we go to the first line, and the first caller is in Whiteheath on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have a bug that is outside, and it lives in this really sunny area of my yard right by the garage, and it looks like a bee in a way, but it's not a bumblebee or anything. It's got about a 1.5 to 2 inch long body. I just was out looking at it, and it has stripes, black and yellow striped tail, and it's got big wings. And when it's very intimidating, whenever you go out, there are a whole bunch of them. I think they live in the ground or something. Then they come up out of the ground and they sort of buzz around. And I don't know if they're dangerous, if they're going to bite. Or if they're just upset because you came out close to where they're living, or I don't know what it is. But
I think what you've come across is one of what I like to see talk about is one of the signs of July. This sounds like cicada killer.
Uh-huh.
And, the females will nest underground, and you'll find a hole. It's about as big around as your finger going down into the ground with a little bit of loose soil around it. It looks kind of like an anthill, only it doesn't have quite as much soil, and the hole's bigger.
Uh-huh.
And what the females will do is that they will find a cicada or other large insect, sting it, paralyze it, drag it down into their burrow, lay an egg on it, cover the burrow up, dig another burrow, do it all over again. The egg hatches out. The larva eats the still alive but paralyzed insect and overwinters down there and comes out the next year. Do it all over again. Now, the thing that's interesting is that the males establish aerial territories, and these may be maybe 50 or 100 feet across or something like this. And what they will do is, as you are walking across an area, you will invade their territory.
Uh-huh.
And they will check you out to see if you are one of two things, either a female cicada killer that can be mated with or a male cicada killer needs to be driven away. But what will happen is that all of a sudden, here's this inch-and-a-half-long wasp hovering in the air in front of your eyes.
Uh-huh.
And then he normally zips to the side and then to the back and then around to the side and figures out that you're not a cicada killer. And so you're useless in his life and leaves you alone. You walk across the yard another 50 feet, you run into another area, it happens all over again, and when you come back, they do it all over again. And so they're intimidating.
I have to mow over their
spot. The males are incapable of stinging. Only female wasps and bees can sting because it's a modified egg-laying device. Males just don't have the equipment. So the ones that are most menacing. Are not going to cause any harm. Okay. They cannot sting you. The females could, but they're very reluctant to. I've known of three cases in my 25 years of doing this type of work where people got stung. Two grabbed a hold of them barehanded and one stepped on one barefoot.
Uh-oh.
So,
yeah, well,
in other words, you could hassle these a lot. In fact, as a child growing up south of Springfield, I used to enjoy filling their holes with the earth, particularly if I could catch the female gone down in there. Of course, she dug it right out again, but it was kind of fun. And I really should have got stung for all of that, but I never did.
So they're pretty
Usually they're a problem in bare soil areas. So if you have good ground cover, turf, whatever, they're less likely to be there. If they're really a problem to you, you can treat the nests individually with Carbaryl or 7-Dust.
Uh-huh.
But we primarily recommend is leave them alone because they're not going to hurt anything.
Yeah.
And they're just part of nature and doing their thing, and you do yours, and you can coexist.
Okay. Well, when I get stung, I'll call you back.
Yeah, you do that. I've had hundreds of people say we're doing that, and I've got no calls returned
okay.
yet.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for the call. So on average, how many cicada does your average cicada killer kill?
I really don't know for sure, but I would assume that it's probably in a range of probably 8 or 10, I would guess, maybe a dozen. And then they also, an interesting thing is that they have their own little parasites that will tend to get in and lay its own egg on the dead cicada and will eat the egg of the cicada killer or kill it in one way or another and kind of take advantage of a situation. So, it's not only they're getting the cicadas, but sometimes there are other smaller wasps that get them and all this sort of thing. But they will take out several cicadas. And, of course, in general, they're attacking the dog day or annual cicadas, as you hear in the evening, which are not numerous enough to really be a problem. We look at them as more of an interesting aspect of nature rather than anything that harms the trees in any significant way.
Yeah. I was just thinking, though, that sounds like it would actually you'd have to have an awful lot of cicada killers to put much of a dent in the numbers of cicadas.
Exactly. I mean, you think about it from a labor standpoint. You got to dig a hole that's 6 to 8 inches deep down in the ground every time you're going to get one cicada. You know, we're talking about a significant amount of work here for a little bug here to take advantage of.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to line number 2, and this is someone in Urbana.
All right. Mm-hmm. For a number of years, around our home, we've been having problems with an insect that looks something like a wasp, but it's completely black. We've been referring to it as a hornet, and I traced it back to some mud nests that are inside sheds that we have. At least I think that's where they live. They tend to build these mud nests. Mm-hmm. They're kind of a nuisance, and I have to scrape them out once in a while. But in terms of whether or not I could actually live with these things, I think you can help me because I really don't know whether or not they sting. I also think that maybe what these things are called is not hornets, but mud daubers.
Yeah, these would be mud daubers, and they will typically make... We have two main groups of these mud daubers in Illinois. One makes kind of a nest that looks kind of like a mud patty up against the wall
that's
a couple inches across and an inch and a half wide or so.
Right.
And the other one is called an organ pipe mud dauber, which will make long, narrow pieces of strands of mud that are usually about 3/8 of an inch in diameter and about 5 inches long or so.
What's the first one called? I think that's the one I have.
It's just called the mud dauber.
It's mud dauber.
Both of these are in the same family as the cicada killer we just answered about, the Sphecid wasps, and they are also similarly reluctant to sting.
Okay,
so
but they do
your
have
chances.
Stingers.
They can sting. Uh-huh. You grab a hold of one, hit it with your hand, and hold your hand against it. Yeah, he's going to sting. You do that to me, I'll bite, and if I could sting you, I would too.
Yeah.
But generally, they're not going to be a problem. You can knock down the nest during the wintertime. Generally, when they're inside a building like that, the secret is restricting their access because they've got to come in and out all the time. Mm-hmm. So if it's in a garage or you keep the door open all the time, usually a real easy answer to that is just keep the door closed.
Yeah, well, it's a shed.
Maybe it doesn't have real good windows in it or something.
Yeah, and there's no way to keep them out entirely. I mean, if they can crawl through a narrow opening, I just can't stop up those openings to that extent. In fact, I have trouble keeping mice out of this shed.
Okay. I would coexist with them if you feel you can. If you feel you can't, then you can buy an aerosol wasp and hornet spray, kind of stake out the place when the female comes to the nest, zap her, and then knock down the nest.
Yeah, okay. Well, I've been knocking down the nests as I see them. Is there anything wrong with knocking them down in the summertime?
No, except that they just keep rebuilding them.
Oh, I see.
And occasionally you'll get them. They'll finally put two and two together and go somewhere else to build a nest.
I was just wondering if spraying the inside walls of the shed would deter them in any way.
Not likely, because those sprays on that kind of a surface aren't going to last very long. And plus, the insects really aren't. most wasps are pretty hard-shelled, and so they don't pick up insecticide through their feet like, say, a housefly does.
So
you're not going to get much control on that, and not much of repellency because they're not going to the insecticide is not going to last long in that surface.
Now, if they should sting someone, is it just a prick, or do they all have a poison like formic acid in their do they have a venom in there?
They have a venom associated with it, and again, how you react depends on how you're made and what your genetics are.
Right. All right, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go here next to line number 4, and that would be Aurora. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I did want to talk about ants, and I live with them, and they don't come in the house. But I spray my back patio, and I really don't want to kill them. What could I do to not have them around my door so I don't kill them?
Well, ants are so common and so frequent around in most of the United States that really they're going to be there regardless of what you do, and I don't know of any repellents that are going to be effective in keeping them away. Various types of ant steaks and so on have a toxicant in it which kill the ants. I don't know of probably the best way to keep them from building nests and so on that come up through cracks in the patio and so on would be to seal the cracks in the patio. That would be the best thing. I don't know of anything that you're going to be able to repel them away from an area with, and outdoors ants are very beneficial, helping recycle nutrients in the soil and so on, and actually do more soil turnover in the average landscape than the earthworms do. So they actually are quite beneficial. And
I don't want them by my back door because they did build a huge nest by my back door.
Well, you either have a choice of killing them or living with them. I don't know of any repellent associated for ants.
Oh, okay. Could you give me the scientific name for that insect that took advantage of, what was that insect you were speaking about? I think it was the first caller.
The cicada killer?
Yeah, and then the other insect came and took advantage of the cicada killers.
Okay, that would be a parasitic wasp, and probably in the family Chalcidae, I would guess. But there's several families of parasitic wasps.
No, I just want to know, what is it called scientifically when one insect takes advantage of another insect's doings?
This would probably be, many times you call this brood parasitism or nest parasitism. It's somewhat analogous to the cowbirds putting eggs in warbler nests and then the warblers feed those birds. That's called that, and it would be called a similar sort of thing. Sometimes it's called... Usually it's called parasitism of one sort or another, but normally this is called brood parasitism or host parasitism.
Is it a symbiotic thing?
Well, in general, even all parasitism is considered to be part of symbiosis, because symbiosis means two animals living together, whether one is being killed by the other or not, eventually. The point is they are living together at least for a while. So it would be considered a part of symbiosis, but it is pretty one-sided. So it would not be what would be called mutualistic, in which both sides get benefit from the arrangement, say the algae and the fungus and making up a lichen, for instance. That's mutualism. But this would be a type of parasitism in which one side of the relationship is getting a lot more benefit than the other.
Then I wanted to talk about termites. Is there anything new and good about and cheap about termites?
I don't think there's a thing that's cheap about termites, either their damage or their control. But within the last couple years, 3 years or so, there's been a new product come on the market. It's fipronil, and it's sold under the brand name of Termidor, T-E-R-M-I-D-O-R. And it, along with the metoclopramide or Premis, which has been around for several years, are effective barrier treatments that will help keep the termites out. And the termites cannot detect the insecticide, so it works much more effective than DERS ban.
What do you mean keeping them out? You mean they come from the outside in?
Certainly. Termites that are in this part of the country are all subterranean. Their nests are down in the soil, and the termites come into the house from the soil. They do not nest inside the house. They only do that in the southern part of the United States, down along the Gulf Coast and on in California and so on, where it's warmer. There you have drywood termites and dampwood termites, which can establish a nest inside the building. But these, what we have here primarily is eastern subterranean termite, which makes a colony in the soil. So one method of control is to provide a barrier around your house that they can't cross to get in. It's an insecticide which will kill the workers as they try to come into the house.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, thanks for the call. Our guest this morning is Phil Nixon, extension entomologist at the U of I. Every once in a while he's here, and we give you the chance to call in and ask questions about dealing with insect pests around the home. Could be something inside, could be something in the garden, in the yard. We draw the line at field crops. If you got soybean and corn, we can't help you there. But everything else for your average homeowner, you give us a call, tell us about the problem. I know Phil will see if he can help you out. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Piatt County is next, line number three. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a couple of questions. Number one, when we open our cupboards, even cupboards that have dishes in them, not just foodstuffs, a small moth, I believe, very mm-hmm. small, often flies out. And we keep all of our foodstuffs in plastic bags or closed containers. And they just never seem to go away. I mean, it's not like a, you know, infestation of thousands, but there's always one flying around. And I just wonder what that is, and is there a way to get rid of it?
Chances are what you're seeing is Indian meal moth, which will create a moth, which the adult is about a quarter of an inch long, moth with a half-inch wingspan. If you see a pristine one, it will have kind of a gray band across the center of a body and kind of a reddish-brown end of the wings. They lose their scales and thus their color very quickly. They will develop in grain products and other types of stored foods, such as not only grain products such as oatmeal, cornmeal, cereal, this sort of thing, but will also get into chocolate, dried fruits, dried nuts, these types of things as well. And you mentioned plastic bags. What will happen is that many plastic bags have minute openings along their seams.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell that by taking your typical plastic bag, plunge it under water, and chances are it'll leak. many of them will. And what will happen is the moth is able to detect the grain odor right there at that point, lays an egg right there. The hatching larva is small enough to tunnel through. And then when the larva gets to be half inch long and fully grown, it is able to make its own hole for the plastic bag to get out. That may be part of what you're seeing, but very likely also you may have some spilled material about in cracks and crevices in the cupboard that if you used a vacuum to vacuum up and dispose of vacuum material, that may reduce that food source as well. Particularly if you're living in a house that somebody else has had before, a pre-owned house, you know, there may have been stuff spilled back behind in the walls or something like this that could be coming from. It's a variety of things that could be possible. They'll also feed on dry dog and cat food, so that can be a source as well. Sometimes bird seed is often a source.
Okay.
So these are, and the control of all of these is putting things in airtight containers, glass jars, Tupperware, vacuum out the cracks and crevices. But your plastic bags are probably not doing a complete job.
That's good to know. The second thing is, am I the first to get to mention about Japanese beetles?
Yes, you are.
Okay.
Well, I read
no prize.
I read in Fine Gardening a natural remedy that said to take leaves from larkspur or delphiniums and throw them in a blender and mix that with a gallon of water and spray it on the Japanese beetles, and it killed one beetle completely dead. And I was just wondering, is there, because of the chemical in the leaves, I was wondering, is that really stupid? Or
Well, I mean, I think it's, in my opinion, it's a method that is not going to be very particularly efficient. You can kill probably more beetles the same way on contact easier by purchasing insecticidal soap and spraying it. And both that and this material will probably have the same effect in that you will have very little, if any, residual activity, which means that 15 minutes later, the beetles are coming to the plant are not harmed at all.
Yeah, that was what I was wondering. And then my question was about seven, is that we do have little bees flying around, and isn't seven toxic to honeybees?
Seven is very toxic to bees, honeybees, and other bees as well.
Okay.
And for that reason, we recommend that one not spray plants that are in flower.
Okay.
Generally, if you're spraying just the foliage of a plant, it's unlikely that the bees will find it. It's more likely if that plant happens to be in flower and you're keeping it off of flowers. But generally, if you're spraying plants that do not have any flowers on them at all, the chances of the bees finding it is okay. relatively slim, apparently, because we don't have bee kills from this type of application in agriculture, production agriculture, or in homeowner situations. So
okay.
we feel pretty safe on that.
Okay, and then the last thing was is that I was outside the other day and I saw this huge, I looked it up, it was a buckeye butterfly.
Uh-huh.
And
they're very cute. They got nice eye spots.
Oh, they're it was so beautiful, and there were two of them, and I believe they were mating. But
that happens.
I know it does. I didn't want to be rude, but they were there for hours and hours, and still there after 9 o'clock at night. So, were they resting or?
Well, commonly. Mating in insects is very variable. Sometimes there are some insects that will mate in just a few seconds, but it's not uncommon for partners to be hooked together for hours.
Okay.
Not always is there sperm transfer occurring during that whole time. One factor that occurs in many insects, and I'm not sure if that occurs in butterflies. I know it does in dragonflies. It's important to for the male to keep the female occupied, should we say,
mm-hmm.
Because at least in dragonflies, the last male to mate with her is the one whose sperm fertilizes the egg.
Mm-hmm.
So the early bird here does not get his progeny. And this is why you many times see dragonflies and damselflies flying like in tandem, where one is
mm-hmm.
hanging on to another. In damselflies or dragonflies, there'll be two together. The male is guarding the female from other males coming in and fertilizing her eggs before she lays his eggs that he has fertilized. So I would expect that probably the long time of being joined together is one way. If you're joined together, there's no way a male is going to get in there and another male and fertilize. So that's probably a good share of a reason for the long period of time.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your information.
Very good. Thanks mm-hmm. for the call. Just before things got going, Phil and I were talking a little bit about Japanese beetles, and you said that the reports are they're certainly here,
uh-huh.
but the reports are kind of variable, that there are some places where they have a lot of them and other places where maybe not so many.
Yeah, we normally see them coming out in the last week of June, and this year they came out in this part of the state. The first report was the 13th of June, which was a couple of weeks early. Probably our hot weather we had in early June and late May, our 90-degree temperatures brought them out early. But we are seeing them spotty. Certainly areas around Bloomington, we've had a lot of reports of very high numbers. My own yard is very light. Some others in the Champaign-Urbana area tend to be light. They're there, but they're not very numerous compared to what they have been in the past. I'm not really sure why that is. We may be sometimes insects come out in just a spotty distribution. But we've also had some reports from particularly the state of Ohio and some other areas, Michigan, et cetera, in which the beetles tend to come out over a period of time. They started noticing that about 2 years ago. I haven't seen that in this state much. And so they come out. There's some of the beetles come out later in July and will lay eggs later, and you end up getting white grubs of various sizes as a result. I haven't seen that in Illinois. I haven't heard about it in Illinois, but it may be we're starting to see that occur, and that may be a reason why some areas are having fewer. There may be more to come.
Hmm. I think your recommendation, we've certainly talked about this in the past, is that for those particular plants, and there are some, while they're omnivorous, there are certain things that they really like.
If you plant it, they will come.
and so I guess that the issue is if there are some particular plants that you really want to guard against damage, you can treat those. Otherwise, you're saying, you know, pick them off if you can, be sparing in your use of insecticide, and the chances are whatever damage they do, they're not going to kill the plant.
Right. They normally are going to kill. They're not going to kill the plant. They're going to – and what you do is you look and see what are the plants that they're attacking that are really important to your landscape. The rose next to the back door, the crabapple next to the front door, things that are very obvious that you really want to protect. We recommend spraying every 2 weeks with Carbaryl sold as 7 or Cyflufrin, which is sold as Bayer Advanced Garden tree, I'm an insect killer, I believe, multi-insect killer, I believe is what it's called. And this will probably need three sprays 2 weeks apart to give good control because they're pretty well gone by the time we get in mid-August or so. You can hand pick them off and just poking at them, they'll drop into a jar of alcohol or soapy water. And this will help particularly if you get on them early because the beetles change hosts. They fly to a new host every 3 days. And if you can keep them off a host, they will tend to go to new hosts that have already been fed on. If you can keep yours from being fed on much, they'll go to the neighbor instead, which is fine. But you select the plants that you really want to protect. And those that, even though they may be hitting them hard, if they're back towards the back in the, by the alley or in an area that's not that important part of your landscape, I suggest reducing the amount of insecticide used. Don't spray those and concentrate on the plants you're trying to protect. It really won't make a lot of difference how much white grubs you have, how much damage you have in other parts of your yard, because when these beetles change hosts, they fly anywhere from 3/4 to 1.5 miles. And certainly the distance between your backyard and your front yard is not going to be important when you got beetles flying that far.
Yeah. And if you don't have huge numbers and you have the time, you can certainly go out and manually remove them, use the old can of soapy water technique, and that actually does work.
Yes, it does. Or you can just put up with them. I mean, even though you may have kind of your signature plant in your front yard that they normally hit and are really hitting hard, you know, if there's just a few up there and they're not causing a whole lot of damage, it's not really all that noticeable, you know, relax. Don't worry about it. If they start, keep your eye on it. If they start really showing up and heavy, then you can spray. And you may save yourself one or two sprays in that method, or you may spray it, save all three.
All right. Next caller here is in Danville, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Phil.
Mm-hmm.
I got a couple, three questions. You mentioned something about the Termidor. Was that the
yes,
name?
Uh-huh.
Is that something that can be purchased by an individual, or does that have to be done by a licensed applicator?
That's only done by a licensed applicator. There are no, what I would consider to be very effective barrier treatments, or even baits for that matter, that are available for over-the-counter. They're all available through pest control companies.
Okay. My primary question today is, I've got an insect that showed up this last Friday, and since then it's just really multiplied exponentially, and it's looked through all my books, cannot find it. It's about the size of a house fly. It's on the sweet corn and zucchini. It goes after the bloom on the zucchini and the leaves on the sweet corn. It's a very boxy kind of a get flies.
Kind of yellowish with black stripes?
No. It's a dark brown with just a real light gray trim on it. I'll tell you, the coloring kind of reminds you a little bit of a lightning bug almost, but it's a very small, you know, about the size of a house fly, very boxy in shape, a rectangular, but I mean it's like almost square in a way, square rectangle.
Yeah, you know, it's...
I was going to take it into the extension office because I cannot reference it anywhere.
You're not seeing any yellow on the wings at all?
No.
It's possible, I'm not sure what it is, it's possible it could be a soldier beetle. And soldier beetles are, as larvae, are predators, but as adults are pollen feeders. And they would be attracted to both locations for pollen.
Yeah, but they're eating everything.
Okay, if they're eating the leaves as well.
Yeah, they're eating the leaves and the blooms. I mean, they're just really ripping into it.
Are you located in the Champaign-Urbana area or far
over
west?
Over here in Danville.
Okay. Because in the western part of Illinois Northwest, up near Monmouth and so on, we get a false Japanese beetle that fits your description to a T. Never heard of it much in this part of the state. It'll look like a Japanese beetle if you're familiar with those, but it will really be drab looking.
No, this is, it's not a beetle, I don't think. It doesn't look like a beetle.
You're ahead to send it in.
Okay. All right.
We're not meshing on description. I could probably recognize it if I saw it, but I'm not really... can't really come up with it.
Sure, and I've also got, it's not a real problem, but I've got a caterpillar that's like a 1/2 to 3/4 inch long. It's a yellow that is almost, it's such a bright yellow, it's almost an orange and blue. It'll grow 1/2 to 3/4 inch, and it is eating the leaves as well.
Leaves
that's
of?
That's on cabbage.
Of cabbage.
Yeah.
Okay, well, there is the, probably what you're seeing is the zebra caterpillar. Zebra cabbage worm, I think. Zebra caterpillar, I believe it's called. Or zebra cabbage worm. It's we're used to the to the green caterpillars that may loop, that's cabbage looper, or the ones that look kind of velvety, that's imported cabbage worm. But we also have the zebra cabbage worm, which will which tends to be yellow and does have some blue on it and has elongated stripes, and it will get on the plants as well. It's not very common. And it is easily controlled with the Bacillus thuringiensis kerstockii, the dipillar thuricide, just like the other caterpillars are.
Well, I'm doing...
Or hand-picking, either way.
I'm doing an organic farm up here, so it's chemicals are out. Is there a natural predator of any kind?
Well, BTK is normally organic accepted because it's a bacterial toxin. It's not a chemical that's produced by humans. So my understanding is normally that's what's used. Certainly rotenone would knock them off, and so would insecticidal soap if you hit them with it, although it's hard to get all surfaces covered on a cabbage that way.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We are a little bit past here at midpoint. Again, I introduce our guest, Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist at the U of I, and for many years now, he's been stopping by a couple times a year to talk about dealing with insect pests around the home. Give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next up is someone in Belgium, line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to bring up the topic of a new eastern pest we may be looking into, and that's the gypsy moth.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, somebody from an official-looking car walked down onto my property and put a little triangular nest on an oak tree I had.
Mm-hmm.
And they came back sometime in the future from that mm-hmm. and carried it away.
Right.
Now,
they've been doing that since the early 70s.
Yeah. And I'm not at all trying to, you know, equate these two things, but this year that oak tree doesn't look very good. Do we have gypsy moths around here very much?
Not if here is East Central Illinois. We do have them established in Lake County, which is the most northeastern county in the state, and they are fighting the battle quite heavily right now in DuPage and Cook County, which are also Chicago metro areas, to try to slow the spread, which is what the program's called, to try to keep them out of this part of the state. But no, we do not know we have gypsy moth here. But depending on funding, they try to trap the state throughout every other year throughout the state, and they have been doing that since the early 70s, and have found small infestations that they have been able to eliminate successfully. And they just eventually got into the Chicago metro area from infestations in Wisconsin and Michigan. So, the Illinois Department of Ag has done a very good job, but they do put out these triangular traps that are about 6 or 8 inches long, about 3 inches on a side. They're either a bright red-orange or else they're a lime green.
And
there'll be a pheromone in there that will attract a male gypsy moth from as much as a mile away. That's a way of detecting if they're in the area. The trap would not have been any indication on the healthier tree, nor would it be an indicator. If you had gypsy moth on your tree in this part of the state, there would have been a public meeting about it. You would have known about it. They'd have probably had a helicopter overhead this spring spraying a couple times. So, it's not in this area, but they're watching for it. By the way, these traps are put out. They've always had a right of trespass to put these out and to pick them up and to check on them. But after 9/11 with Homeland Security, they even have more so. So actually... You know, if any of the listeners find one of these on a place where it really doesn't fit or anything, you can contact somebody and they will come out and move a trap.
I see. Well, I wasn't concerned about that because I knew what the traps were
right.
about.
But I was just putting out for other people.
Yeah. When gypsy moths attack an oak tree, which is their prevalent species,
uh-huh.
do they totally kill the tree or can the tree come back from it?
Tree normally will survive 3 years of total defoliation before succumbing if it's in a landscape. Those in the forest actually survive, and it's not a gypsy moth is not a serious mortality factor in most forests. That will take out the stress that they put on by defoliating. They typically defoliate in sets of 3 years at a time. Will kill off those trees in the forest that are weak, getting old, being shaded out, whatever the case may be, but in towns and cities, the we have enough other stresses on the trees, such as soil compaction, salt from snow and so on, things of this nature that impact the health of a tree, sidewalks, covering root systems, things like that, that usually 3 years of defoliation or row will kill the tree. And so generally in areas where the gypsy moth has come in and has been there for a long time, such as in the Northeast, what we've seen is a change in the urban forest away from oaks. And this has happened because through not only natural factors of a gypsy moth taking them out, but also synthetic, in that you don't want to plant another tree. It's just going to be eaten. So you pick something that a gypsy moth don't like. And that really eventually drops the numbers and drops the problem.
I see. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. On to another caller here. Next person is going to be Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I got a problem that's puzzled me. I had an experience with a device for catching mosquitoes years ago. It had a light in it and a fan in it.
Uh-huh.
Are you familiar? Are those still around?
Yeah, usually what they will do is suck them into either a chamber or onto a sticky board that they adhere to, one of the two. I don't know how commercially available those are. I know they were popular for a while. They are still used by mosquito control companies. They're one of the common names for them is the New Jersey Light Trap, which will have a fan which sucks the mosquitoes in, attracted to a light at night. And it's a way of determining how many mosquitoes are out in broad terms and what species are out. And it's used by mosquito control companies to know whether an area has a high enough number of mosquitoes to warrant control, in an IPM fashion, rather than just spraying, you know, every week or whatever. But I have not seen them advertised for a while. I will tell you that their effectiveness as far as keeping you from being bit is going to be relatively light. Because what will happen is that mosquitoes may be attracted to vicinity, but if you have a female looking for a blood meal, she's going to maybe be attracted into your yard from your neighbor's yard, but then she's going to look for blood, not go all the way to the trap. So they are a good way of telling which mosquitoes are out, because they will attract males and they will attract older females, so they'll know what the species abundance is and so on. But they're not really going to eliminate the mosquito problems of biting you.
Isn't a mosquito attracted to people because of the carbon dioxide in their breath?
There's a variety of things. That's one thing. They're attracted to large, dark objects, so wearing light clothing helps. They are, and to a mosquito, all of us are large. They're also attracted to lactic acid, which our pores exude for muscle exertion, and also to carbon dioxide. And usually it's large dark objects from a distance. As they get closer, it's lactic acid. And as they're looking for a place to actually bite, they tend to switch to looking for carbon dioxide.
Well, if I put a cube of dry ice in a device like that, that would give off carbon dioxide slowly. Or
that's
a
right.
Tank.
And that happens to be used in another mosquito trap that is used by pest control companies.
Oh, they do make something like that.
Well, yeah, they do. Uh-huh.
It has a tank of gas in it?
It actually, what they will do is they'll put a cube. Typically, what they try to be as low-tech as possible. So what they do is they will use a cube of dry ice, and it just exudes carbon dioxide for a couple of days or 3 days, and they check the traps twice a week, so they just replace the carbon dioxide, the dry ice. Of course, you can buy the mosquito magnets and similar materials that use propane to produce carbon dioxide, and those are commercially available, although, again, they have not been tested fully enough to know whether they're all that effective in reducing the number of bites that you have.
I also hear that there's spraying for mosquitoes in catch basin places like that. Is that effective where they breed?
It is, particularly for disease-carrying mosquitoes, the ones that are transmitting West Nile virus and St. Louis encephalitis. They are container-breeding mosquitoes. They're going to be in tree holes, clogged gutters, old tires, tin cans, and catch basins. And many times what they will do is spray the catch basins or apply or put in a a BTI, a Bacillus thuringiensis israeliensis material, which is a bacteria which will kill the developing larvae, and that's or Bacillus sphericus, which works better against the insects that the mosquitoes that transmit West Nile, and they will treat catch basins and many mosquito abatement districts have been doing this for years, and it does help.
That's it. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. That's been my experience that hasn't been so bad a year for mosquitoes so far. Is the dry conditions actually having an effect on the numbers of mosquitoes?
Yes and no. Certainly it does. What will happen is if we have a lot of rainfall, we will get the inland floodwater mosquitoes, Aedes vexans, which will be a real problem attacking in large numbers, buzzing your ears, driving you inside, all of that sort of thing. But they're typically not disease carriers, usually not. Whereas the ones that will transmit West Nile virus and St. Louis encephalitis is Culex pipiens, a northern house mosquito. And it really starts to come in its own when it gets hot and dry in late June. It has a very close related species, which tends to be more numerous, Culex restuans, which can move the virus from bird to bird, and then the Culex pipiens bites both birds and humans, so we'll transmit bird diseases such as West Nile virus and St. Louis encephalitis to people, and although they are present from early spring, they become much more numerous through July, August, and into September. And they like putrid water, which is really nasty smelling, and they actually don't do as well when it rains a lot and the water gets too fresh and clean. They really like it nasty. So very occasional rains with hot, dry weather in between is just perfect for that mosquito, and our conditions we've got now would make us, and time of year it's getting to be, we need to be watchful and concerned about being bit, and these are little sneaky mosquitoes that you normally don't notice, and they're a little brown mosquito, usually don't buzz your ear, they just come in and land and feed. So you got to be wearing DEET repellents is helpful, and there are other repellents that can be effective, and these will help protect you and watch getting bitten in the evening, particularly when this mosquito's flying.
Okay. Again, two other callers. Urbana, line three. Hello.
Line three?
Mm-hmm.
Say, I heard you talking about the mud daubers a little earlier as I was driving, and it reminded me of a thing that came up a few years ago with my stepdad. He was complaining about the vent pipe on his sanitary system being stopped up with mud daubers, and I told him, I don't think that's possible because I don't think a mud dauber would build a home where it could see sky above. Was I wrong?
I've heard of that as well. I really don't know for sure. These weren't all verified that I'm aware of, but I think that probably a mud dauber might do that, although we have small enough numbers of problems of that occurring that I think that it's probably not very common. Yeah, How's that for a roundabout answer?
Yeah, I just figured that they would not build where they could see sky above because rain could come from there.
Well, certainly they're going to want to be protected, as you might guess. If you make your nest out of mud and you get a lot of water on it, you got a problem. So you would not expect it to happen, although I have heard of them, and certainly other creatures will build mud nests where rain can get on them, such as chimney swifts and things of that nature. So we
found it was rust, but
so they would probably prefer not to, but I wouldn't put it past them.
I raise squash, pumpkins, and things every year, and every year I have these root maggots.
Uh huh.
What can I do about them, and when should I do it?
Well, typically root maggots are going to be the larvae of a fly, and an interesting feature that the fly needs is that apparently in order to lay its eggs, it needs to touch soil with its feet, its tarsi. And anything you can do to keep the fly from being able to touch the soil next to your plants will reduce the number of root maggots. And so floating row covers, which you can put on early in the year, typically the insects are going to attack in the spring of the year. So from the time the plants come up to maybe when they start to bloom, and you need to have those row covers off for pollination from bees and so on, those would probably help. You can also, anything that you lay down alongside the plants to cover the soil. Some people use newspapers. You can use window screening. Some people use aluminum foil, things of that nature. Anything that will keep the fly from being able to touch the soil will greatly reduce your number of root maggots.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. We continue here, and next caller is in Potomac, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have been noticing that there's huge numbers of earwigs in my backyard, and I'll lay my water hose down, and it doesn't have an end on it, so when I turn it on next, they wash out a couple of earwigs.
You're lucky it's not 70.
Well, I don't count them, but they kind of, I don't like
I've known of people who couldn't get anything to come out of their hose because there were so many earwigs in it.
Yeah.
I had to shake it and bounce it around a little bit and knock some earwigs before the water would come through it.
Well, maybe we'll get into that later on. Are they dangerous?
No, they're not dangerous. They feed primarily on dead organic matters. They will feed on fleas. They have very broad feed habits, and they will feed on green plants a little bit. Typically flowers, petals, particularly of flowers. And we many times will recommend Carbaryl or 7 on the foliage part of a plant to help reduce that if that's a problem. But generally, these little guys, which for those people who haven't had the pleasure, are about 5/8 of an inch long and kind of reddish brown with pinchers on the back end. They're not going to. They'll come in the house. They're not going to reproduce in the house. They don't maintain in the house. They don't make more in the house and outdoors. They just are kind of feeding on dead material primarily. And if you can live with it, that's probably the easy thing. No more earwigs than you've got. There a lot of people don't like the looks of them. I tell people, they don't like the looks of you either. They're really not going to harm anything, and normally you don't need to do anything for control.
Well, it just seemed to me that they're looking particularly sleek and fat this year, and there's a lot of them.
Well, I've seen more than I sometimes see, so this may be a good year for them. And chances are they will cycle and may be numerous for 3 years or so and then become less so.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. To Muhammad next, line two. Hello.
Hi, Phil. I live in a wooden house. It's a redwood. It's got redwood construction in decks and things like that. And I'm infested by a bumblebee. The bumblebee seems to burrow a perfectly round, almost 3/8 inch hole. But what happens is then they hollow out the beam into which they burrow, and they seem to know when they're close to the wall because they never pop back out. All you see is the little hole where they go in. And I just wonder, are they doing structural damage, number one? Number two, is there anything in particular that I could do or should do about it?
They're doing some structural damage. These are carpenter bees, and they will tunnel as much as a couple feet up the beam. And if you have a lot of them, they will cause a considerable amount of damage. Usually they do not attack wood that has a finish, more than a stain. Normally, if you've got a polyurethane finish or varnish or something like that or paint on it, they're not going to attack the wood in most cases. Where you've got a hole, you can put 7 dust around the opening, and they'll carry that in and kill off the individual. What will happen, what they do is they make a hole up through there, and they make a series of cells in which they fill with pollen and then lay eggs on. The larvae hatch, feed on the pollen, come out later in the summer as adult bees, which overwinter and come back in the spring to do it all over again. What you do not want to do is caulk up that hole until late in the summer, because people do this with some strange idea that will kill them, when obviously they tunnel through wood to get there, they can tunnel through wood to get out, and instead of one hole, they have 6 or 7 holes all in a nice row right down their piece of wood, where each individual bee decided to make its own hole to come out. So that's counterproductive. But if you can bring yourself to put on some sort of a finish that actually forms a film across the surface, such as maybe a matte polyethylene that's outdoor safe, that may help keep them out. Chances are your redwood may be old enough that it's been weathered enough that it's lost some of its natural oils that would have helped keep some of these guys out.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, bye. And we go to Normal. This is the next caller, line number 4. Hello.
Hello there. Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking my call. I am bothered by about a 1/2 inch long, thin insect that gets in my washcloth. This morning when I opened the coffee pot to put fresh coffee in the old filter with wet coffee grounds, there was one in there. And they seem to be all over my house, in the sinks, in the bathroom, and especially anywhere damp.
Do they jump or crawl or just kind of wiggle?
No, they're just they're about a fourth to a half an inch long, and they're very thin and fragile and grayish looking.
Okay. What you may have I'm not sure what you've got, but it may be that you have drain flies. And particularly if you see little flies that are, or gnats that are about an eighth of an inch long and triangular shape, look like little black moths sitting on the walls, this would be the adult stage.
Oh.
And they will live in the drains, and you may want to clean the drains out, use a drain cleaner on that, or even use a brush that goes down the drain and knocks off some of the debris on the inside of a pipe. This will help get rid of them, and they won't be as numerous around to lay eggs in other locations. The other thing, of course, is, as you mentioned, they need moisture. And so the more you can do to hang up washcloths to dry, leave a coffee pot open to air dry or dry as best it can before you close it up, these sorts of things will help keep them from being a problem.
Is there any drain cleaner you recommend?
No, anything cleans a drain will help get rid of the slime on the inside, which is what these insects are feeding on as larvae.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, very good. We'll try to get one more at least. Three, Champagne. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
This is just a general question. I've never had my house checked for termites, and possibly when I bought it 24 years ago. Not sure if I recognize the signs of termites, but is it a good idea to have it checked, or should I just, since I haven't had any problem?
Usually it's a good idea to have your house checked every 3 to 5 years, and most pest control companies will do this with the idea that they may find termites and thus get some business from you. If they do find termites, get another. I'd get two more companies in to see if they also find termites, and then you'll have some bids that you can choose from. But it's a good idea, as a general rule, to have your house checked every 3 to 5 years.
We're going to have to leave it there. And my apologies. I think we have one more person we can't take. But maybe again later in the summer. Phil will come back. We'll do it again. Phil Nixon, he's extension entomologist at the U of I. And from time to time, he's here on the program to take questions about dealing with home insect pests.